And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our next guest is Stephen Levy. He has written Facebook, The Inside Story. Now, for 3 years, tech writer Levy has had unprecedented access to Facebook's key executives and employees, including Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg. His new book, Facebook, The Inside Story, is a fascinating narrative that digs deep into the company's history, revealing fascinating new insights, and he tells the full story of his company that has changed the world and reaped the consequences. Stephen Levy, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It's great for having me. I'm happy you have me.
Well, it's great to have you on the program. We really enjoyed the book, and we have so much to cover, including Cambridge Analytica and users' personal data and Zuckerberg's power and all these other things. But first, before we start, a friend of mine interviewed Mark Zuckerberg, and he was given the famous stare down, and he was so uncomfortable. He didn't know what to do. He wasn't sure if this guy was having a seizure or not. But this happened to you as well. What is going on?
Yeah, the very first time I met Mark Zuckerberg, this was 2006. Zuckerberg was 22, the CEO of a young company, and it was getting a lot of noise, dominating the college market at that point. And I wanted to meet him, and I arranged a meeting, and we sat together at a lunch at a conference. I asked him these softball questions: how big's your company, how many campuses? And he just stared at me with his big, wide eyes. Looking like an anime character almost. And it was very unnerving because normally you answer these questions. And it seemed the time stood still. And eventually I tried another tack and got him to respond. But this was something, particularly in his younger years, that a lot of people were exposed to. And to the last, it made them incredibly nervous and didn't seem to bother him at all.
It almost seems like a kid that holds its breath.
Well, I mean, it turns out, and I looked into this, it really seems that it isn't like he's having a seizure or something like that. He's just like thinking and pondering it and taking things in. He's the kind of person who is so secure in himself in a way that he's not really overly concerned about how you're going to react to him.
Right. Well, if you could take a moment and tell us about the genesis of Cambridge Analytica. There was a policy decision that Facebook would encourage software developers outside to create apps and software products. Tell us how that happened and what went wrong.
That's right. And I think you've sort of got the real origin here. We all learned about Cambridge Analytica, or a lot of us did, in 2018 when the thing hit like a thunderclap. And actually, about a year and a half earlier, there was an article exposing what happened that people didn't pay much attention to. But it really happened in 2010, and arguably a little earlier, when, just as you said, Facebook started to offer free information about its users to software developers, people who write applications, who wanted to create these applications that were social and that would run on top of Facebook. You know, just like people write an application for Windows, the Microsoft system to run on your computer. And in order to do that, you would sign up for one of these applications, and you would get information passed on to the developer, and also some information about your social network, who you're in touch with. And Facebook decided in 2010 to get even more information about the users of these apps and their friends to the developers. So these developers include not only applications like games, but taking a survey. So you sign up for one of these surveys, and the person who runs the survey, this could be just like a single person, gets not only all your information, all your likes and your contact and your relationship status and things like that, but that information about all your friends. So an average person on Facebook has 130 friends. So it doesn't take a lot of people to get a database of millions of people with these detailed dossiers on them, likes, for instance, which come to these developers are very revealing. And one researcher found that, you know, with like 10 likes, they know your sexual orientation, your political orientation. And if you have enough likes, 300 likes, you'll know more about a person than their spouse would. So this is an unbelievable amount of information that's handed over. And when one particular researcher who did surveys, naturally, decided to violate Facebook's rules and sell this information to this political group that worked for far-right candidates and then for Donald Trump, that's when that scandal happened. But the real scandal is handing over that information so freely.
Stephen, you talk about how, in the case of Mark Zuckerberg, his most cherished accomplishments became liabilities, and just what you're talking about, where it was perhaps a sort of blind innocence or an intense focus on the part of Zuckerberg to develop software and algorithms that could suss out this information without perhaps the nefarious tendency to want to capture all this data. It was more, or was it, I guess is my question, about, you know, development of the software and less about capturing data that would infiltrate all of our lives.
Yeah, the advantage you get when you write a book like this, you can really develop this and see how it happens over a period of time. And you could argue that when Zuckerberg created Facebook in his dorm room, literally in Harvard, his intention was not to do anything that could disrupt democracy or hand over huge amounts of data to, you know, to people, but just a way for people to be in touch with their classmates and meet new people from their classmates' social networks. But over the years, and it didn't take too long for Facebook to become a serious business. It was funded for millions of dollars. He was in touch with some of the smartest people in Silicon Valley, certainly the smartest people in the social networking world. And he wanted very badly to grow Facebook very, very quickly, and largely for competitive reasons, to make sure no one else could take him on and challenge his company. And when growth becomes a goal in and of itself, then you do things which maybe skirt the lines of what's proprietary, you know, what's proper to do, right? And and that's what happened with Zuckerberg. And, you know, he would constantly make decisions that even people around him would question, to say maybe this violates some privacy or maybe this isn't quite right. But he's figured, let's go do it, and if something bad happens, we'll deal with it later on.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Stephen Levy. He has written the book Facebook, The Inside Story. And Stephen, you know, again, to that sort of blind innocence of Zuckerberg, he was so young, you know, he was 21 years old, and he's dealing with his mentors and early investors in Facebook like Sean Parker and Peter Thiel. And it's funny, you mentioned that they thought they were manipulating this young whiz kid. And in fact, well, what?
Well, I mean, as it turns out, one person who was close to Zuckerberg in the early years told me, and he said, like, well, they thought that he was this naive kid who they were helping out, but they were really doing the things, you know, that he didn't want to do. He didn't have much interest in it. He wasn't so much interested in raising money as he was in building things. So he liked the engineering side. He liked the product side. And these people, the people who funded him, Sean Parker, you mentioned, the guy who was involved in Napster, Justin Timberlake played him in that movie.
Right.
You know, he did a lot of things for Zuckerberg, and, you know, Parker did well from it. He wound up a billionaire, but Mark Zuckerberg did a lot better and, you know, eventually fired Parker, and he's got a lot more billions.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, I just wanted to go back to Cambridge Analytica for another question, and that's for me. It's not hard to project what the unintended consequences of the software apps might have. Do you think that Facebook knew that a Lex Luthor might sign up?
Well, I don't think when they started that platform, and that started 2007, as I said before, that in 2010, that version of the platform really opened up the vaults. I don't think they were thinking that, but over the years, and certainly before Cambridge Analytica, they had plenty of indications that this data handover could be abused. There was, a team that was charged with, among other things, auditing what happened to make sure that the information wasn't handed over to third parties. But people told me and people who worked at Facebook then told me that was a low priority. They never really worked too hard at that. Had they worked hard at it, maybe they wouldn't have been that handover. Nonetheless, even what was within Facebook's rules was kind of shocking. The fact is that this researcher who wound up giving the information to Cambridge Analytica or selling it, when he had the information for his own research, information on over 50 million Facebook users, the vast majority of whom had no idea that this guy had the information, that was perfectly within Facebook's rules. So people just didn't realize the extent to which Facebook was giving that information away.
Yeah. You know, several years ago, Lynn and I did a program and did an interview with a young man in a small town in Macedonia. And he was part of the disinformation campaign that took place. Is Macedonia still operating as one of these organizations, or have they been shut down?
Well, I think their job has been a little harder after Facebook has spent more energy to crack down on it. But you're right. Particularly, it reached a peak around the 2016 election, where Macedonia was the source of an amazing number of very popular posts on Facebook. And generally, they were like made-up stories assigned to made-up publications. The classic one is the one from a publication called the Denver Guardian, which repackaged some right-wing blog post saying about Hillary Clinton killed an FBI agent or something. And the Denver Guardian, gee, that sounds like a real publication. Isn't that the newspaper in Denver, you'd ask, if you never lived in Denver? And it turns out that the address they gave for the Guardian was a parking lot in Denver. But this made-up story from a made-up publication was way popular than, for instance, the really substantial New York Times series about Donald Trump's finances, by a big multiple. So, and that's on Facebook, because the way Facebook is designed, the news feed, which is that stream of stories you see on the front page of everyone's Facebook, doesn't really distinguish in a glance between a made-up publication and a really substantial one. It may seem to allow a way that you can mouse over and see the difference there, but it hardly makes up for the way that Facebook, by design, is crafted to make something random look as substantial as, like a 100-year-old institution.
Stephen, I'm curious, in the news today, there have been so many conspiracy theories raised around coronavirus and COVID-19. And I'm wondering how much you implicate with what you know. How much do you implicate Facebook in the rise of the conspiracy theories?
I have to say, to Facebook's credit, they have learned some lessons about this, and they've tried to get in front of the inevitable misinformation campaigns about COVID much more than they have about things in the past. For instance, in the anti-vax stuff that circulated on Facebook, it took years of people complaining about it before Facebook actually said that they would do anything, even to fact check it and can let people know that vaccinations don't cause autism or whatever. So in this case, they're trying to get ahead of it, but because the system still promotes things that people engage with more, it's a tough job to do that. Even something that they're looking out for, they have to work very, very hard to suppress.
So trying to get ahead of it, that's noble. Failure to adapt or slow to adapt have been some of the terms directed towards Facebook. And I'm wondering, you know, I notice that perhaps slow to adapt, failure to adapt has also created the situation in which Facebook is no longer used by anyone younger than 25 years old, maybe even 30 years old. It's evolving into perhaps a thing of the past. And how has that happened?
Well, on one hand, you know, we all say that, but they just announced their, you know, results, their earnings yesterday, and there's billions, literally billions of people, multiple, over 2 billion people using the main Facebook Blue app. And, you know, if you add in the people who use Instagram and WhatsApp who are owned by Facebook, and, you know, and get rid of the overlaps, there's almost 3 billion people on the Facebook world. And one way Facebook addresses that is to have bought those other properties. And they not only took competitors out of the market, but they brought in younger people. And a lot of people who say that they're not on Facebook, they turn out sometimes they do use Facebook, maybe not as a regular practice, but a younger person might use it to say hi to grandma or whatever.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the future. Mark said his vision for Facebook and the thing that he's really trying to focus on is private messaging that would be end-to-end encryption of private messaging. And we've certainly seen some unintended consequences of some other moves of Facebook. Is it possible for people to skirt the U.S. intelligence gathering apparatus by having all this encrypted end-to-end messaging so that they can take a group of people and communicate that intelligence organizations would not be able to shine a light on?
Well, the short answer is yes, it does make it harder for intelligence agencies to surveil content on the internet if it's encrypted like Facebook is or like Apple does with its messaging systems, that even the company can't decode it if they get a subpoena to do that. It does make it tougher, and it's a bigger argument, really. I mean, people of goodwill on both sides have arguments to make about whether people should be able to communicate privately. As it turns out, one of the most valuable executives at Facebook, the guy who I would have thought would have been the person to take over Facebook if Mark Zuckerberg got hit by a bus or something like that, quit Facebook. And one issue of contention was that he thought just that you know, because, you know, WhatsApp and Messenger were going to be all encrypted content, and then Facebook messaging, you know, would be the same. He felt that it would make it less safe, and he was concerned about that and disagreed with Zuckerberg.
Yeah, these are tough decisions, aren't they?
Well, they certainly are, but there's plenty that Facebook could do. I was actually struck. I talked to Brian Acton, who is the co-founder of WhatsApp, and he's a libertarian, and his view was, you know, hey, if people want to use things on WhatsApp that, you know, is dangerous, you know, can incite people to riots, that's not our fault. That's people's fault. Can let other places sort that out. We're just giving them a tool. So, you know, he was an extremist way beyond where Zuckerberg, for instance, stood on this. So I was a little surprised at that. But there are ways by, you know, like seeing who people communicate with. And in the case of WhatsApp, you know, WhatsApp allows you to basically be a broadcast medium, not just a messaging medium, by allowing, you know, users to forward things to hundreds of people. And then those people can forward it again. So within a few steps, you're really reaching a big audience. So in certain cases, in some countries, Facebook has limited that forwarding. So if Facebook really wanted to crack down on that, they would crack down much more harshly on the forwarding, and you wouldn't be able to forward a message to 200 people who could then forward it to 200 more. Just keep it to smaller groups.
That's interesting. Stephen, you've been touted as the best technology writer out there. You've been afforded a glimpse into the personal world of Mark Zuckerberg and others at Facebook. And I'm wondering specifically about Zuckerberg. Whether or not his moves are predictable by someone like you who has seen so much, do you feel like when you see a story in the news or you're writing one that you say, I bet he's going to go this way, and then he does, or is he not?
I think probably I've gotten to know him well enough that I'm not surprised by a lot of the things he does. I could have told you, for instance, that for the coronavirus, he was going to be more proactive on this. He was going to go off on that. Facebook has a new initiative about an oversight board, which is, you know, something they set up that's presumably independent that could overrule Facebook's decisions on content, what comes up and what goes down when people complain about it. That doesn't surprise me because he both wants Facebook to be a mode where people can express themselves, but also a safe place. But he doesn't want the responsibility of policing speech, even though this is a platform he created. It is not a public square like he sometimes refers to it, but it's the, you know, messaging systems of a private company or, you know, a public company, which he owns as if it is a private company. It's a whole, you know, under his control. So it's something that Facebook built. And then he says, we don't want to take responsibility for policing, you know, people's expression on it, right? So that was a perfectly predictable move because it removes him one step from ultimate responsibility about some of these decisions.
Do you believe that he's entirely unapologetic about that? Or do you feel like, because I read somewhere that he was a fan of Caesar, who's a very empathetic, though power-hungry ruler, and that was
Augustus Caesar, our favorite. Yeah, so
yes,
not Julius.
Right. Augustus Caesar, and so that empathy. I don't know. It stuck with me. Like there is empathy there. Is he just feigning being unapologetic, and he really is taking it to heart? What do you think?
Well, I think it is tough to really get to the bottom of that. I mean, he has apologized in the last couple of years for some of Facebook's misdeeds. I think he's sorry he's in such trouble for what happened there. But I feel, you know, there's two things going on. I think he is genuinely sorry if, for instance, something that comes of Facebook ends in harm to human beings, as sometimes happens. On the other hand, he is in the mode of Caesar, very ambitious, and he's kind of a conqueror. I talk in great detail about the way that he acquired these companies, Instagram and WhatsApp and Oculus, and it is very much in the mode of a hunter going after them and getting the founders of a company who didn't want to sell. They thought that they could build their own company and be a next Facebook on their own, but he was able to turn them and sell to him when he was in the same position, you know, earlier. He resisted that and didn't do that, you know. So that is something that I think made him very proud, that he was able to take those companies and make a great strategic move on the amazing risk board, which is the competitive situation in social networking and the internet.
Yeah, that's fascinating. We had the person that runs the Stanford Interactive Lab that has virtual reality and everything, and Mark had visited with him and walked the plank.
Is that Bailenson?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just talked to him the other day. He's interesting.
Yeah, good guy, really, and we're going to get him back on the program, but he was telling us the story of how Mark asked him so many questions about virtual reality and wanted to know everything about the goggles, wanted to know everything about everything, and then 3 days later, he bought Oculus.
So he was doing his research on that. He didn't tell Jeremy, but, at that point, he did a crash course in virtual reality. I lay out the story where, he had them come up from Southern California, and they took over Sheryl Sandberg's office because his office was in glass, and people walking by on the campus could see what was going on there. And, you know, Sheryl's was a little more shrouded, and, you know, you pull the shades down. And he got a demo, and he said, wow, this is the future. This is the next version of, like, what mobile was to the desktop, and, like, the next big thing. I have to own it And within a few days, they sealed the deal for a couple billion dollars that he would own what he pegged as the leading virtual reality company.
Yeah. Stephen, we're almost out of time. And, you know, we could talk to you for hours. But just a quick question. Is there anything out there that you wanted to know about Facebook that you couldn't find the answer to?
That's a great question. I think I satisfied pretty much all the questions I set out. I mean, obviously, who knows what the ultimate future is for them. I think, you know, there are some mysteries still with Mark Zuckerberg. He's a person I mentioned. He keeps his cards so close to the chest that sometimes you'd wonder if he took off his shirt, you'd see the imprints of the suits on it, you know, on his chest, the spades and the, you know, and the hearts. But I felt I did get to know him as well, certainly as any journalist could know him. And I spoke to a lot of people who had known him pretty well in social situations, and they say that there was parts of him that they couldn't reach. He's a fascinating character, and he's very clearly very smart, but also very, very competitive. And, you know, he always cites this innocence thing that you guys mentioned. And I came to really get impatient with that when he bring that up. At one point, I literally said to him towards the end of our conversations, Mark, don't give me the idealism thing. The fact is, you know, you're crazy competitive, you know, and that drove a lot of Facebook's moves. And he gave me that stare for just a little while and then said, well, I guess you're right.
Oh, boy.
One thing we didn't get a chance to talk about, Stephen, but I think our listeners would like to know this, is just about the notebooks that he destroyed, but how he kept his vision and his all of his design for the company in these notebooks. I just thought that was so interesting, and you describe in great detail how he went about recording and creating in the notebooks. And they sort of weave through the story a bit. And I just thought that was very interesting. So figured I'd bring that up before we let you go.
Yeah, well, one thing I heard about these notebooks that he kept in the early days of Facebook, where he drew up a whole vision, as you say. And as someone writing a book about Facebook, I thought, wow, I'd really have to get hold of that. But I learned he destroyed the notebooks. But then I found that he sometimes would make copies and pieces of them for people, and I set about on a quest to get a big chunk of that, and I actually did. I actually got a big chunk of the most important notebook that he made when he was basically rethinking Facebook past the college site into something where everyone in the world would have it. He was designing what became the news feed. Got hold of the notebook, and it was really a window into his soul.
Stephen Levy has written Facebook, and it's the authorized Facebook, The Inside Story, over 9 interviews with Mark, tons of interviews with Sheryl Sandberg, and many other people.
It wasn't quite authorized. They cooperated, but they had no say over the content.
Yeah, I think you did a pretty good job. But listen, thanks for joining us, and will you promise to come back?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Plenty to talk about in Facebook and the world of tech.
Thanks, Stephen.
Stephen, stay safe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.